Work today. I'm going to really ask everybody to be as brief as they possibly can. We want to get through that agenda. Remember, we have five sessions to do all the bills. And in some of the bills that we might be ready to move today, we don't have fiscals and revenues, or we don't have all the amendments ready, so we'll be carrying it over. We'll be talking about it.
You don't need fiscal on it, do you?
A revenue?
A revenue on...
Yeah, I'm not sure I need it to go to... We're going to get a hall pass and send it to... Use the revenue.
I think.
Cindy, is that right? Do we have a hall pass to send that to revenue without having the revenue impact?
I don't have the hall pass yet, Mr. Chair.
Do we need it?
We should have something.
We're going to have a very brief public hearing on 3611, and maybe a work session. The intention of that is to refer it to Revenue Committee. I'll make a statement on that. Then we'll open up 3626. Superintendent Castillo is here and needs to be out by 4, so we'll make sure that happens. And we'll see where we go from there. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3611 and ask Representative Maurer to open the discussion, and we have one other witness.
You want me to do it here or down?
You can do it wherever you like to.
All right, Mr. Chair, I will stay up here then.
Okay, and Mr. Buckstein, you want to join us at the front?
Okay. We had a conversation last time, and what 3611 does is, in my view, it's an issue of fairness about the tax treatment of an individual purchase of a health insurance policy. Currently, if you're a business, you can deduct the full cost of the health insurance premium. If you're self-employed, you can deduct it from your federal income. But if you work for an employer that doesn't provide health insurance, if you are unemployed or you just purchase health insurance on your own, there is no deductibility for it. There is an issue within the tax code that makes that disparity seem unreasonable when we want to encourage people to purchase health insurance from 100% to nothing. And so the question, and the bill just addresses a 100% deductibility, but the real question, I believe, is there a conversation, a policy conversation to be had about maybe limiting or capping the deductibility of health insurance on the business side and giving some percentage of deductibility on the individual side. There's a money conversation. The fiscal is something around $162 million as this bill is written. But we also, the state gives approximately $1.2 billion a biennium lost revenue is not the correct word, but in revenue that goes back to the taxpayers. And so I'm suggesting that we actually have a policy conversation about what that should look like in the future. My hope is that it would ultimately be designed as essentially a revenue neutral position, but also addressing fairness for those individuals that are doing the right thing for the right reason in purchasing health insurance. And I will stop.
Thank you. Mr. Buxton?
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. I'll be brief. I just want to say, seconding what Representative Maurer said, and as you already know, why, if I purchase or if I receive insurance through my employer, does he get a tax deduction, but if I purchase it myself, I don't, which, by the way, is my situation. So you're looking at least one of the individuals in Oregon that purchases his own insurance. I think the whole reason we're here is really a historical accident in the tax code in the country that drove insurance to be provided by employers, and you probably all know that history, or if you don't, you can find it out. But I would agree with Senator Wyden that providing insurance through employment is not really a good idea for a number of reasons. It harms the economy. It creates what is called job lock. But until we move away from employer-provided insurance in one way or another, we're dealing with this fundamental unfairness that employers get the tax deduction and individuals don't. I understand you're hearing a pay-or-play bill coming up at this session. That would be unnecessary if employers didn't provide insurance. I think As Representative Maurer said, there is a way to look at making something like this revenue neutral, not just capping, you know, the individual's deductibility, the so-called Cadillac plans, I guess, is being talked about at the federal level, but also individuals. And the very individuals that I think could save you money by giving them this tax deductibility oftentimes are ones that are either on state insurance now because they can't afford to go out into the private market, or ones that may, if they don't have insurance, suddenly through accident or whatever, become dependent on state services. So making it easier for those people to buy insurance themselves by making their premiums tax deductible, I think there would be a way to figure out at least roughly how much money the state would be saving by some people not falling under state services. So again, I think it's a fundamental matter of fairness. Tax all of the premiums, or don't tax any of them, at least up to some cap. At least make it fair, and that's what I'm asking for. Thank you.
Great. Are there any questions of Mr. Buckstein?
Representative Maurer.
Are there any comments on the bill? I need to say that I have had discussions with the revenue chair and Representative Maurer. The revenue chair is interested in seeing if it would be possible to work out some way, or at least to consider this in some form, and I will take a motion to move it to revenue if we have the hall pass to do so, and I'd like comments on that motion. Representative Kotek, here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I remember when we had the informational on this.
This is comments on the motion before we have the motion, but let's do it.
Well, and I just want to thank Representative Maurer for bringing the topic forward. I think it's merits further discussion, perhaps in the policy committee. I have concerns. I think you might be interested in moving this to the revenue committee. Given the items they have down there and the time we have in this session, I'm not sure we're going to have time to go into this. And my preference would be a continuing policy conversation. I don't know if it's appropriate to move it to revenue for this session.
Can I?
Please.
And I agree. I mean, this is a very large policy discussion. It's a money issue that needs to be addressed over a long term, but it is absolutely impossible to get good information on or to begin the policy discussion. I mean, the initial fiscal revenue that I got was $162 million, and they admit that the information they're basing that on is not applicable to this scenario. I would like to, I don't know where that data exists, and I would like to be able to push some buttons, and the only way we can do it is not in this committee, is revenue, is saying we need to get some real numbers so that we can have a real policy discussion, because right now we can't push the correct buttons to get the data we need. I absolutely agree that this is, February is not the correct time to be messing with fundamental tax code.
Well, and I'm all with you. I think the only really to understand where we can go is to have some numbers. I guess if the chair's permission, I see some folks from the health authority here. Is there a spot within the Oregon Health Authority, the Oregon Health Policy Board discussion, where we could ask them to do? I know it would require working with LRO.
$450,000 fiscal.
Yeah. Oh, really? To study it? Okay. Well, I didn't know. I just saw Dr. Smith walk in, so I didn't know if she had any feedback. But I'm with you. I just, again, sending it to revenue might not get us there, but I think we need more numbers. I just don't know what the
best. You are correct.
Part of the strategy, I have no problem keeping it here. Or as Representative Mao, we get back to it in the last 2 weeks of the session. But the sense is that if it's not in revenue's possession, we can't get legislative revenue to work seriously. Now, you have more push in some ways than we do.
I suspect they're not going to work on it right now either. But, you know, it's...
Anyway.
Well, and legislative revenue is going to get their numbers from somebody. And where are they going to go? They're going to go to the insurance division, which I would hope would be able to maybe get some numbers, and to be honest, I don't know. But everything we look at now is based on employer-sponsored insurance. We are not talking about employer-sponsored. This is the individual market, and those numbers aren't readily available.
I must say many of my friends are going to have a problem with me on this, but I think it is a matter of fairness. And I think it's more important than that. I think it's a matter of stimulating to buy individual health insurance. And I mean, I think it's very much in the state's best interest if more people step out and buy individual health insurance, and the extent to which it might be tax deductible might help that. We don't have a hall pass anyway, so let's close this hearing.
No hall passes.
No hall pass yet. Wait a minute, do we?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just talked to Revenue Office. They are working on it. They will hand deliver it. If you want to close the public hearing and then come back into a work session when they deliver a hall pass to us, then you can
and
work
then,
with that.
And decide whether to move it or not.
Correct.
Okay,
and
we can do that later.
It will be shortly.
But we have some other comments. We have a couple more minutes. Let's go.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say that Representative Maurer and I have talked about this too, and from the business owner's perspective, it's interesting as well, because as a business owner, I do deduct everything that I pay on behalf of all of my employees, regardless of how it keeps going up. And if it were capped, I might be able to, here in this job, I try to affect changes on healthcare and to try to bend the cost curve. I don't have as much motivation, perhaps, as a business owner, being able to deduct every cent of it, as I might have if I couldn't deduct all of it. I might be prone to lobbying a bit more hard through my professional associations and such.
Well, we're kind of doing a semi-work session, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
In fact, let me close the public hearing and open up a work session.
All right, now we can really work. I guess a question for Representative Maurer. If you think about making this practicable in this session or any other session, from a revenue standpoint, you would have to, I think, find at least some offsetting revenues from the loss here. And would you be open to, would you support reducing the deduction for employers, or is that possible? I mean, so have parity, but reduce the deduction, the eligible deduction for employers, while creating a new deduction for individuals?
The answer is yes. I mean, my thought was, President Obama, the cap at the federal level that was discussed was $24,000. And that there was a penalty for any plan that exceeded $24,000. I don't see penalizing someone for buying an expensive plan, but limit the tax deductibility, which means it's now just ordinary income to the value above a certain amount. We cap retirement contributions, but we do that because then some people would put everything in and would pay no tax. So I think there's a reason to deal with the tax code. But there is a dynamic. I don't think you want businesses to jettison purchasing health insurance. So maybe that's why you have a differentiation in tax deductibility. But those are, you have to have a conversation with real numbers. And I have been unable to get real numbers. But there is a hydraulic to, increasing one from zero to something. And at some point, you have to put a cap.
Yeah, and it would be interesting to see when you're looking at numbers, given what's happening and likely to continue to happen, frankly, to medical insurance costs, to see what this credit, what the curve is on this credit over time, and that even in existing law, right? Are we going to have to, just from a state fiscal perspective, can we afford a 100% credit on these benefits over time?
And I don't have the number in front of me. I think the increase from biennium to biennium was $100 million from 07-09 to 09-11. And so that's $100 million more dollars that were not the deduction, but wasn't collected. And, but it's because of the rising cost of health insurance, which is a result of the rising cost of health care.
Given the relative number of the people that have individual versus group, my guess is if you had a 90% rather than 100% deduction on the business side, you could get a 50% deduction on the individual side and be revenue neutral.
Yeah, this is part of the conversation that we were having yesterday, and I think you can get there.
Okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to close the work session, and I'm going to carry this bill over till tomorrow. We may not get to it tomorrow, but we'll carry it over until Monday if we don't. In the meantime, Representative Kotek, Representative Maurer, others of us can have a conversation. I know the revenue chair is interested in this as well, and maybe we can make some horseback estimates so we know what we're talking about. We are obviously not going to make this change in this session. Representative Maurer doesn't expect that, but I think we want a full and open discussion about it.
I appreciate your openness to the conversation. If we can get over, because at the end of the day, there's people that are going to hate it, and there are going to be people that hate it on both ends of the spectrum.
That's how you know you got it right.
Yeah.
And maybe that's where you get it right.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Buxton. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3626 and ask Superintendent Castillo to join us. Who else have we got?
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlich and members of the committee. I'm Susan Castillo, the State Superintendent of Public Instruction. I'm here today to support creating a vision screening pilot program and urge the committee to pass House Bill 3626. I'm very happy to see the legislature taking up this bill again this session. I did work with Representative Wisnant on the version that we had last session, and my staff worked on that bill and we supported it. And we do believe that, unfortunately, it was the economic crisis of the last session that just didn't allow for the pilot to happen, but I think there is a need for this pilot to go forward. As you know, our schools are required by administrative rule to provide some vision screening for their students. And this vision screening is mostly done in the early grades. Our nurses oversee the screening. It does involve other school staff and volunteers. And it is often a very basic screening for our students, where students are, we use the basic vision screening chart that all of us are familiar with. And kids are, usually it's, covering up one eye at a time and reading the chart. So this bill really is a good first step in creating a pilot so that we can provide some more comprehensive exams for our students. This bill would allow ODE to contract with an entity to conduct the exams in three school districts across the state, and then we would be reporting back to you in the 2011 legislative session. I think we all know that good vision is critical for our students to help them learn, to help them with literacy, and especially for our struggling students, really helping them overcome whatever obstacles come their way in their learning. I think we've all heard stories about kids who are struggling and then they get a really good vision screening and discover that, yes, they do need some help with their vision. So I really believe that this is the right step. I think this is also another way for us to ensure that we also can help kids get a very strong early start in school. I think we all know how important that is. So I just have a brief statement today, just here to say that I support the bill, and hopefully we find some funding to make this happen.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any questions? Well, let's hear from Representative Kotek as well.
And Mr. Chair,
we can grill both of them mercilessly.
And the superintendent does need to leave. She has a 4 o'clock, right. So I want to make sure if anyone had questions for her.
Are there any questions? I have one brief question. If we could find a way to move this forward, looking for private funds, would we be able to manage it that way if we could get?
We would be happy to work with you on a solution. However, we can get some funding together on working on this. It'd be great.
Great.
We just need to make this progress.
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
No, I mean, this is good. I had an opportunity to visit with the KCI Institute up in Fort Lauderdale,
mm-hmm.
and had a phenomenal conversation, and there were some concerns, and I don't know if it's Casey.
Mm-hmm. But, be here.
Excellent. Yep. Because they, there were some basic concerns, but the question is money, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Great. I think we have some amendments to deal with some of the concerns.
Okay.
Thank you very much for
coming.
Representative Kotek?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, House District 44, North and Northeast Portland. I want to thank the Superintendent of Public Instruction for being here and making that, continuing to support that linkage between the health and the ability of students to learn and succeed in school. Before you today, you should have the Dash 2 amendments, everyone up on the dais, and I wanted to walk through the Dash 2 amendments with you. The Dash 2 amendment completely replaces the original bill, as we are on a very fast timeline.
And the Dash 1s?
Well, there was a Dash 1. Now we're on the Dash 2.
Okay,
yes,
so
look, we're just talking about the Dash 2s.
This is what we're talking about.
Yes, the Dash 2s today. And so we had heard from stakeholders about some changes. So I want to walk through the changes in the Dash 2, and it's elaborated in my testimony, which I think you should have. Yes, you do. But the overall goal of the project hasn't changed. So those of you who signed on to this bill, it still would create a pilot program to find that model that can most cost-effectively and efficiently identify a screening program in a pilot set of schools so we could build a model that we could take statewide and report back to the 2011 legislature on what this project results that we have to share. The changes from the original bill are as follows. Did you remember from the original bill, we talked about comprehensive vision screening? I know it might seem like a small change, but we took out the word comprehensive because there was some concern that really what you, the only thing that's ever going to be totally comprehensive is the exam with an eye care professional. So we want to just make that clear that the vision screening is a public health tool. It's supposed to try to identify problems for a referral to a professional. So that's why we took out the word comprehensive. In section 1.1, in the original bill, we had a much more expansive, broad list of all the things we should be screening for. There were some concerns that that would maybe predispose what methodology would be used. So what you see in the Dash 2s in section 1.1 is more of a baseline definition. At minimum, you should do these three things. Now, a proposal that's awarded the grant could do more, but at least those three things would be dealt with in the pilot. In section 1.2a, lines 9 through 12, it became clear that we needed a stronger description of the purpose of the pilot. So we wrote that into the Dash 2s that really clarifies that we're looking to, you know, do evidence-based, cost-effective methods for identifying students who may have vision problems that interfere with learning and school performance. And so it would be incumbent upon the people, the group, whoever making the proposal, to explain the methodology as it relates to identifying those problems that could affect learning or performance in school. In section 1.3, lines 17 through 20, in the original bill, we had 10,000 students would be served. The further we looked at the deadline and the timing of this, we thought to provide maximum flexibility for the proposal, it's not so much about the actual number of students served, but how we do it and how well we work with the school. So what we put in here instead was serving the greatest number of students practicable with the resources available. That's why we took out the actual number. In section 1.7b, where it talks about the things to be reported, we just frankly clarified it because it was kind of all mixed together and wasn't totally clear. So it's the exact same kind of content, but just a little more clear. And then there's a new section 3 in the Dash 2s that allocates $150,000 for the pilot. We just wanted to be clear that we think $150,000 will cover the modest administration costs of the department as well as enough money to actually make this happen in the timeline provided. So about the timeline, I've laid it out for you in my testimony so you would be clear about what we're talking about. This is very ambitious, but it is doable. The department will be able to issue a request for proposal probably usually 60 to 90 days, but they've said by the time the bill goes into effect, we should be able to have an RFP out the door by the 1st of May. That would require the RFP awardee to work over the summer to identify the school districts, then spend the time in the this coming fall to actually do the screenings, then write the report, and then report back. So it's a pretty ambitious timeline, but I want you to understand, you know, why we've written it the way we did, and it really will depend on the proposal that comes forward to hit that mark. I also outlined for you again, what's really critically important, I think, is the kind of information we're collecting. Again, I don't think it's a winning proposal would be, for example, how many kids who could do the most kids in a screening program, but if you combine
the most number of kids with the best program to identify the most need with a follow-up and a referral system, which has been a problem that has been raised by advocates. Sure, you could screen and identify, but you have to have the referral. You have to know what happens once the child has been identified. So there would have to be some kind of referral tracking process in whatever proposal went forward. And I think I'll leave it there. I do Sandy has a copy of a -3 amendment. Since I'm here, I will speak to you briefly. There has been ongoing concerns about the definition about what is actually a vision screening. And so the -3s, if the committee were so interested and would prefer those, actually removes the definition completely and just speaks to the objective of the pilot program, which is more broad, which would allow for any number of methodologies as long as it was meeting the criteria of the objectives, which would be to be evidence-based, cost-effective, and identify vision problems that interfere with learning and school performance. So if you would like the -3s, I know we couldn't move those today, but I wanted to have those prepared because you might hear testimony that would prefer something like a -3, which is exactly the same as the -2, except without the actual definition.
And at the moment, which do you prefer?
Which do I prefer? That's a good question, Mr.
Well,
Chair.
Well, think about that. You don't have to answer right now. We can do it in this.
All right, I will let you know on that.
Representative Harkin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Rep. Kotek. So in the -3s, we would not even specify near visual acuity, distance visual acuity, and stereopsis, correct?
That would be correct, yes.
Okay, thanks. Follow-up?
Yes.
Not on that. Separate question.
No, I'm sorry.
Come on.
Okay, then I'm
all right. Section 1.3, line 17 through 20, was where there were 10,000 students, I believe was the number, and that's been modified to be the greatest number of students practicable.
Correct.
Is there enough information available to know what the minimum number is to yield significance? Or have there been any power calculations done so that we don't go down this path and come back short?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Harker. It's an excellent question. My assumption is, and you saw in a previous amendment, we could probably hit the 7,500 student mark. But I think that also relies on every school being ready within a certain time frame. But I think anywhere from the 7,500 even to the 10,000 mark is possible. It depends on the proposal. But I think we would be getting close to that.
And do we know enough about the, from any pilots at all, from the results that have come out of the tests conducted as they are by the different groups, that we will, with 7,500, be able to see significant difference?
Mr. Chair and Representative Harker, I think you'll hear testimony today, particularly from the Children's Vision Foundation, who I've been working with directly, and they could speak to some of the practicability of doing that number of students. Again, I think it depends on the model and the type of proposals that get submitted, the relationship of the awardee with the schools and how well they can get, you know, up and running. But I would be very surprised if we didn't have at least 5,000 students screened, if not more, up to even 7,500 or more. I think it really depends on the proposal, which I would assume the department would be, that's one of the things they'll be scoring it on, who has the best proposal to meet that magic combination of doing the best proposal with the best process and doing as many kids as possible.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, Mr.
Yes.
Are there ways maybe to limit the pilot because it's already being done in districts using criteria that are very similar or are the same as this, but the data just hasn't been forwarded?
Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, I think the challenge about what's actually happening in all the schools is we don't know. And so this is a slightly different approach. It says, let's invest a little money. Let's find someone who can put a good proposal together and look at three different school districts and say, what would a really good model look like? Because to me, the most important part of this is that set of recommendations at the end. What were you able to achieve and why? And is this something we could, you know, take statewide? How would we implement it? How would we replicate it in different schools? Because there is a variety of what's going on in each school right now. And depending on who you talk to, some will feel they have great vision screenings, and others will say, we don't do any at all. This says, we're going to take these three schools. We're going to do it right. They're going to come back and tell us the results and how we might do it in all the schools, and that's kind of what we're going for. I don't know if that answers your question.
Could you reorder that just and say, let's find out what we're doing, and then let's do the pilot project, because that may help you identify which districts maybe you want to go to and say, this is a great program, let's do it in this district. So that instead of say, well, we don't know what we're doing, so let's do three pilot programs. Instead of, the first question is, well, what are we doing? And then, based on that, then maybe the pilot program makes sense.
It may be more expensive to try and gather data of the things that are going on. It is to start afresh and design it from the beginning.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Maurer, if I could clarify, it would not be three pilots. It would be one pilot in three different school districts in diversity of size and geography. The goal being to see if there are factors in a small school, in a large school, in a rural school, you know, try to get a combination so we can see if a model works in all three schools.
Okay.
Having my experience with the school nurse bill and the amount of time it took to figure out what we were doing around school nursing, we could take a year to do that. And I think most people realize, I don't think anyone has had a problem with why we're doing this, which is we know there are students who need to be screened because they have vision problems. And we could, I'm not sure so we could find out what everyone was doing and then we would say, okay, and are we happy with that? I don't know. I'd rather have someone come in and say, this is really how it should be done. And here's why. And here's my proposal. Let me show you how it's done. And then we go to those other schools next time and say, okay, why aren't you doing it this way?
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. Oh, you want me?
Okay, we have five witnesses. I really want to ask you all to be very brief. We're really running into time problems. And we may have a fiscal on the dash twos, which may make that a more preferable choice. So we'll see. Can I call Julie Bibler and Wayne Schumacher, please? And then after that, we will have a panel. The last few witnesses, Carol Strong, Glenn Gilbert, and Joanna Vaughn will be the next panel. So, the bill we'll take when we finish this is, just for reference, is 3632.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, I'm so thrilled to be here. What an opportunity for us to really be working on behalf of children. I know that the questions that you've asked and Representative Parker has asked, I have some answers to that and some history with that. You'll be getting written.
Please introduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Julie Bibler. I'm the director for the Children's Vision Foundation. I have been working with state people for a long time, been working on doing vision screenings for over 12 years and have 20 years worth of volunteer experiences in schools, working with teachers, PTAs, you name it. And you have a lot of that down, and I'm going to be respectful of the time limit that we are looking at. This opportunity to bring a bill like this and be able to take care of kids is really important. I see children every day in schools that cannot see well. And it's essential for us to be able to go in and actually be finding those children. In 2008, the House Education Committee asked me to present information on the children's vision in our state. I had specific data on thousands of children at that time. And I had our chairman, Peter Buckley, of the House Education Committee at that time say, we are building prison beds based on the number of third grade non-readers in our state. That is without even checking their eyes. We know those group of individuals that are out there that are needing this. I see them all the time. You asked whether there was information done. In 2008, the Oregon Health Forum did a survey with all the school districts in our state. Based off of that information that was presented at that time, they found that numerous school districts didn't know what kind of screenings were happening, if they were happening. They were talking about who was even doing them, and they went through and said at that time with the Department of Education, what's happening? How can we not be knowing this? And that is what came up with the task force and the process that we've been working on since 2008. I have specific data that I've given to you in blue packets that last month. You have before you another packet of information with a written testimony. Along with that, you will find that there are letters from numerous different people of letters of support. I have many of them. I'm not going to share all of them, but I thought you might want to see some of those. Next to that, you have a three-packet form that shows what goes home to those families and what is given to the teachers so that they know what students are having problems. Then we did a follow-up survey a couple of months later to find out how many of them actually were receiving care, had done something, etc. For those school districts that we would have involved, we could then go ahead and put a spreadsheet together saying these students had vision issues, these people had received care, here's further ones that we do. When we get done with all the schools, like on a biennium in the smaller communities, then we come in and we every other year we do all first through fifth. That's more fiscally efficient because since you're not going in and doing just one, two group levels or whatever. In the Ben Lapine, you have information from 10 years of experience in those blue packets, and it shows the difference between a 22% referral rate to a 14 to 18% referral rate. So hopefully that kind of numbers and information has already been provided. If you need any further information, feel free to get a hold of me, many of us have been working on this stuff, but we feel like this is a perfect time to be taking care of those kids. Representative Parker, you talked about the number of kids. We've ran through the numbers. We look at how many kids we do, reports, etc. That is a doable number. I know it is because we've talked about it, okay? We should be able to go over that, but it's the quality and the consistency with connecting with teachers and things, okay?
Thanks. Thank you for being brief. I really hate to be rushing everybody, but we're in this 30-day session. We have everything we have to do in the next 2 weeks, and it's a big problem. Are there any questions? Yes.
I, too, will be very brief.
Good.
My name is Wayne Schumacher. For the record, I'm the executive director of the Oregon Optometric Association. And we're here, and you have my testimony, so I won't regurgitate that specifically, but we're here to urge your support for 3626. However, we weren't aware of the Dash-3. I've just heard about that, as has been explained, and that essentially addresses all of our concerns, frankly. And that was Section 1, lines 1 through 4. I think the removal of that certainly would take care of our concerns. We believe that the criteria set forth lower in the bill, particularly Dash 2s, would actually adequately address the criteria we need. So, again, unless there are additional questions, we'd want to urge your support for Dash 3s, and if not Dash 2s, and then to amend.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
Can we have the next panel, please? Carol Strong, Glenn Gilbert, and Joanna Vaughn.
You mentioned Dash 2-3s.
I'm passing them out right now. I just got them.
There is a Dash 3, as Representative Kotek said, simply eliminates the definitions on in line 4 through 6. Who's first?
Hogan Lyon. What can I say?
Okay. Clock's running.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, committee members. My name is Glenn Gilbert. I'm the executive director of the nonprofit Oregon Lions Sight and Hearing Foundation. We are the largest vision screener in Oregon. The Sight and Hearing Foundation screens over 30,000 people per year, and that includes about 25,000 children. Last fall, in the months of September, October, November, we screened over 9,000 school children. We've been doing this since 1994, so 16 years. And in that time, we've screened about 340,000 people, again, mostly school children. want to make sure you realize that about 40% of all children who have learning problems have vision problems. We often find kids who are being tested for learning disabilities. We get a pair of glasses on them, and all of a sudden they can see the board. It makes all the difference in the world. We do this out of two 18-wheel trucks that literally drive all over every county in the state of Oregon, and our mobile screening units, where it's like basically all the tools that you would need to do this are on the truck, as well as hearing. We do this with volunteers. And currently, I believe that all of the folks on the panel, as well as the folks you just heard from, are nonprofit organizations. So this is being taken up and being handled by nonprofit organizations at this point. We do it on average for about $6 per child. And that's because we do it with volunteers. We do it with professionals as well, running the program, but volunteers are what allows us to do it so inexpensively. We also are experimenting with screening kits, where we don't need to have a big truck to bring this to your community. We can literally roll it in, as we've seen it done at Pacific University, in a suitcase on wheels, where we take it into the school gym or auditorium and screen children. We're here to endorse and support HB 3626, and we especially applaud your proposal to define vision screening. In particular, we applaud the potential funding for a pilot project to help pay for the screening. As the superintendent said, right now the schools are required to screen kids' vision, but they don't have the funding to do so, so they turn to the nonprofit organizations to do so. I want to tell you a quick story about where I grew up. There was no vision screening. There was nothing like the program that we run at the Sight and Hearing Foundation to come, and the school did not screen kids' vision. It turns out that as a child, I had the problem that is called amblyopia. Does anybody on the panel know what amblyopia is, what it's commonly referred to as? When I was a kid, they called it lazy eye. And lazy eye has almost nothing to do with the eye. It just has to do with the fact that the eye and the brain aren't communicating. And the reason I asked my panelists to sit to my left is I'm blind in my right eye because of this problem. Screening, literally looking at this and telling me whether or not you can see the 3D, just like a Pixar movie, would be able to tell you the difference between whether or not you're seeing with binocular vision or not. It's a very easy thing to do, and it takes about 10 seconds. You could all do it yourself if you wanted to, but if you don't catch it by the time a kid is about 10 years old, it's too late. The brain will turn off the signal to the eye because it's confused by a strong signal in one eye and a weak signal in your other eye. And unfortunately, after 10, there's nothing doctors can do to fix the problem. So it's inherent that we screen kids, not just for whether they need glasses, whether they're nearsighted or farsighted, but whether or not they have this problem. There's also a problem called strabismus. All you would do is patch the strong eye for about an hour a day, and after about a year and a half, the weak eye, like a muscle, suddenly starts to work. The signal does not get turned off. If you don't have one eye, you have a much higher chance of losing the other eye than most people. The other thing, of course, is you don't have peripheral vision, so I can't see anybody approaching me from over here, nor do you have depth perception, so I made a terrible center fielder when I was in the Little League. They put me at second base. I did okay. We know, based on statistics, that 4% of kids in the United States have amblyopia. So 4% of kids that aren't caught with this kind of screening go undetected will have a chance of losing one of their eyes. We also know how easy this thing is to catch and how easy it is to fix. We know we're catching 1,000 kids a year with our screening program that get sent home with a piece of paper that says your kid needs to go and have further testing done, either with an optometrist or an ophthalmologist.
Just start wrapping it up, please.
I will. In Hood River last month, I got to get out of the office and go and actually participate in one of our screenings myself. I caught my first kid that had amblyopia. It was really thrilling to know that this six-year-old kid was going to go home with a note that I scribbled on there, get this kid to an optometrist right away. HB 36 could prevent thousands of children losing their vision and help many more do better in school. I also, this past month, went to a school screening. I won't say where, but it was a school screening that was not one of ours. I wanted to go see how they were doing it, and it was, I would say, subpar. They only did distance visual acuity, which is from about 10 feet, and you get down to the 20-40 line. They did not do the test that would test to see whether or not you have binocular vision, nor did they do this quick near vision test where you're taking the same 10-foot chart or 20-foot chart and doing a flip. It's very easy to add those things. So Representative Kotick is right. It's all over the board, the way the screenings are being done around Oregon now. And I thank you for the opportunity to testify and be happy to do a vision screening on anybody who wants.
Well,
it takes about 3 minutes.
We've suggested that when the session's over at 5:30, if any of the members would like to be screened or any of the audience, that you'll be available to do it at that point, huh?
That could explain some behavioral issues. But.
I think we can do that.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Good afternoon, Representative Greenlick and Kotek and members of the committee. My name is Carol Strong. I'm the Northwest Regional Director for Prevent Blindness America. I cover the states of Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming. In case you weren't aware, Prevent Blindness America is the nation's leading eye health and safety organization, and we're dedicated to fighting blindness and preserving sight, and we've been around for 101 years and recently in the Northwest. Our focus is on public professional education, advocacy, and research, and we provide the only certified vision screening and training program in the country. Recently, we screened over 3,100 children in the Portland Public Schools, and in cooperation and partnership with the Oregon Lions, the Esler Foundation of America, Multnomah ESD, Pacific University, and many of those partners. Within that project, we not only screened those children referred to the appropriate comprehensive exam, and also provided all the glasses and continual support that they needed. Because of our stature and longevity, we're able to draw on a board of directors, leading experts in the field of vision, research, ophthalmology, and optometry. It's also true that many of our Children's Vision Committee continually reviews the scientific literature for the latest research on children's vision needs, appropriate screening protocols, and effective tools. Our scientifically based screening protocols are simple. They can be administered by lay volunteers, and we have trained school nurses, staff, and other volunteers all over the country and in this part of the Northwest. Our purpose is to find those children who need that comprehensive eye exam and to make sure that they're adequately identified and referred as appropriate. Some would advocate that all children should receive a full eye exam upon entering school, and perhaps even at regular intervals after that point. This often places an unnecessary burden on children, their families, and the schools. As you know, Oregon law already requires vision screening, and the schools would benefit from a policy to establish the minimum screening requirements. The Prevent Blindness America protocols require that school districts, at a minimum, include what we call the observations, the ABCs. We teach our volunteers how to look for behavioral signs, complaints, their appearance, and we test for the distance vision using appropriate scientifically based tools. We use what Mr. Giles showed you for the stereopsis screening, very important to us, and make sure that all the follow-up procedures are identified for the schools. Too many schools are using antiquated screening tools at this point, have too few resources and little support to provide high-quality screening programs. With this legislation, the process can begin to raise the standard, but restrictive language suggesting protocols that are not readily available would cause confusion in the schools and restriction among the vision partners who've already been trained and the personnel, the lay volunteers that are already in the school using those protocols. With your new bill, -3, that may change all of that. We do, however, support the bill definitely in the intent of the bill. Prevent Blindness America believes vision screening is the most cost-effective, efficient, effective means to ensure that all children receive the eye care necessary for the health of their vision and their academic success and life success. We'd be pleased to be a resource. I provided some additional information to Representative Kotek and Greenlick, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for your brevity. Ms. Vaughn?
Hi. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joanna Vaughn. I work for the Oregon State Elks Association and OHSU KCI Institute's Elks Children's Eye Clinic. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I applaud the work of Representative Kotek and the other members of the committee on HB 3626. Today I'm here on behalf of Oregon Health and Sciences University, and I'm testifying in support of the legislation, specifically with the adoption of the -2 amendment. I have been with the Elks Children's Eye Clinic and acting as the vision screening director for 6 years and 5 months. This program provides effective, low-cost vision screens for primarily preschool-aged children throughout the entire state. And when I mean the entire state. We are screening kids from Ontario to Ashland. and we're identifying children with potential vision problems. As a way of background, the Oregon State Alts have been supporting the pediatric eye clinic at OHSU since 1949. And for the last 6 years, the Elks have donated more than $500,000 to fund free preschool vision screenings throughout the state. Each year, the program has been growing to reach more children. To date, we have provided screenings to approximately 13,000 children, and we have collected eye exam charts from over 700 children who have been, and these children are from both rural and urban areas. Results of this research has been internationally recognized, and more importantly, kids around the state are receiving free vision screenings that may not otherwise have been available to them. The methodology for the screening is based on the latest scientific research on pediatric vision screening. The method is endorsed by the American Academy of Pediatrics and Prevent Blindness America and can be easily replicated throughout the state. To date, more than 98 vision screening kits have been donated by the Elks to Head Start health coordinators and are currently in use throughout the state. In addition, we have been able to finance the training of hundreds of lay screeners, as well as collect valuable research data, which has helped validate the methodology and provide quality control. In fact, we are excited to present our research at the World Ophthalmology Convention in Berlin, Germany, in June 2010. If anyone is interested, I'll be glad to share this data with you. Anyone on the committee, I'll be glad to share the data. Although, through my own personal experience with kids and the results of our scientific studies, I believe that the inclusion of the near vision screening provision can lead to over-referrals. The pilot program calls for a study of the most accurate, cost-effective way to deliver the vision screening, so hence, I believe the program will hopefully look at all of these potential issues and make screening recommendations accordingly. I also look forward to participating in the pilot research project in some way. Again, I applaud the work of the legislature to develop a pilot program to help provide lay screenings for Oregon's children, which will be based on evidence-based research. If House Bill 3626 is amended with the dash to amendment, as it appears likely, OHSU strongly supports the legislation. Thank you, and I will be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there any?
Sure.
Go for it.
Sure. So the dash three eliminates the definition. Vision screening means an eye screening that tests that three sentence. Is that okay? Is the dash? How do you have a feeling on dash threes?
I haven't really had a chance to look at it at all. So I mean, it's just off the top, you know, off the cuff. One of the things I've been trying to do throughout the state is establish a methodology, and I've laid a lot of groundwork with the preschool population, which, as we talk about amblyopia, is the age where you can treat amblyopia. So that's where we're spending our scarce dollars, but. You know, we would. My job in a small town like Burns. When I'm in Burns, I don't want to have the discussion on which methodology we should be using or if my methodology is correct or not. It's based on the American Academy of Pediatrics, and that's, you know, I'm very confident in the. We have research to validate it as well.
Okay, thank you all very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3626. Carry over House Bill 3626 to tomorrow. We'll have fiscals on all three of them. We'll have a brief work session, so it would be useful if you have any questions between now and then, if we have those ready. Yes, ma'am.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief comment on the dash two versus the dash three. To me, at the end of the day, I'm less invested in putting into statute what a vision screening should look like. I think what the most important part is what you see in the dash threes in section one, which says let's find a program that really deals with identifying what those vision problems are and allow the proposals to speak for themselves. So I would be supportive of the dash threes. I know some folks haven't seen them, so I'm glad we'll clear this over to tomorrow. So if people have feedback, they'll get it back to us before.
And we'll have the fiscal on the dash threes.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're hoping. Just in case I didn't mention, I think I want to make sure I did, we'll be carrying over 3611 until tomorrow as well. open a public hearing on HB 3632. Invite Representative Witt, Mr. Shiprack, Betsy Earls, maybe for the first panel, and then we will have after that Janine Smith. Oh, Mr. Ames as well? Is he joining you?
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, if you've received the Dash 1 amendments?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Okay, thank you.
Okay. We have, huh? Those are the ones that we were talking about before?
Yeah.
Yes.
Do we have a fiscal?
Yes.
Do we have a fiscal on them?
Yes, but not a revised, Mr. Chairman.
Not one on the Dash 1 amendments?
We do. We do. I'm sorry. Let me take a look.
36.
I have the revenue on the Dash 1, I believe.
So this is going to Ways and Means anyway.
Yes, please do. I don't have a fiscal on the Dash 1, Mr. Chairman. I apologize.
Okay. Well, it'll be carried over till tomorrow as well. Let's see if we can get a fiscal on Dash 1. Let's go.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, State Representative Brad Witt, House District 31, introducing Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3632. When I last visited with you, of course, we explained that the bill was requesting a study by the Oregon Health Authority to determine the viability of a pay-or-play health care system for the state of Oregon. When I made that presentation, I think in my mind, the model that I was working on was a Chevy Bel Air. When we got the plan back, I think what it was an Impala possibly moving towards the Super Sport model. The Dash 1 amendments describe a Biscayne and would invite you and the committee to get aboard and support this bill. Happy to answer any questions.
Just not
have
a Toyota that'll zoom ahead.
No.
Zooming ahead might be okay, right?
Mr. Chairman, this is a made in America model, and happy to present it to you. The intent, of course, for the language would be to arrive at a zero fiscal. Thank you very much.
Next.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jonathan Eames, and I'm here on behalf of the National Electrical Contractors Association, as well as third-party administrators in the state, a number of different ones. You all have heard this very recently, so I don't think I need to go into the details of the bill. However, I will say that we brought this forward, and Representative Witt graciously offered to bring this forward because we wanted to look at some different options. In last legislative session, during the 2009 legislative session, we had a lot of different options that came in front of you and a lot of different funding options. And we felt and we promised during those hearings that we would look at alternatives to different funding options for healthcare and a different way of looking at healthcare in Oregon. And so this was an opportunity for us not to come forward with you with a proposal of our own, but to look at this and study this in an appropriate way and in a measured way over the course of an interim to come forward with an alternative. And that's what we're trying to do here. And I hope you're pleased with the idea of a study in the interim. So I'm here happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions? Thank you, Mr. Shiprack.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
He's there beside you to punch you.
Bob Shiprack, Oregon Building Trades Council. I just testified a couple weeks ago on this bill. I think you probably remember my testimony. Just to reiterate, I watched this committee and the Senate committee agonize last session and in previous sessions over how do we pay for health care. I'm here today just to suggest something that my friends in Maine management and I had a hallway discussion suggesting that the study look at how we fund the workers' benefit fund here in Oregon, where just a couple cents per hour, which is collected off of the consolidated forms that the State Department of Revenue has, it raises quite a bit of money in that fashion. And I would just encourage in the study to look at that model. It's all employers have to fill out that form anyway.
it just seems to us that it might be a simple way to collect some money for health care in this state. It would be fair, and obviously it's already being used to provide benefits for injured workers and their dependents now. So just trying to be helpful, I guess. Hope we can look at it, and maybe it's a solution that works for you guys.
Thank you. Any questions?
We're going to hear from the authority.
Yes.
The authority.
Yes. We are.
The.
Would that be me?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We again, we don't have a fiscal on the dash one, so this will be carried over as well till tomorrow. And I expect to hold several very short work sessions tomorrow to move things we already know what we're doing. Ms. Earls? Dr. Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, is this working?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yes.
Okay. I'm Betsy Earls, representing Associated Oregon Industries and appearing before you today in opposition to House Bill 3632. Oregon is still in the midst of implementing major changes that we made in the healthcare delivery systems last session. And two of those changes increased funding for low-income healthcare services. Those have not yet fully achieved their intended results. We hope and expect that they will have good results, but we suggest to you that before Oregon looks into the idea of imposing additional requirements on employers, we stop to evaluate the impact of the changes that were made just last session. Generally, pay-or-play systems require employers to either pay for health insurance for their employees or pay a fee or a penalty to the state. Right now in Oregon, many employers do not provide health insurance for their employees because they cannot afford to do so. If employers who do not currently offer insurance are required to pay a penalty, their employees' wages and other forms of compensation will likely decline by the amount of that fee or something close to it. Proponents of pay or play argue that because employees already bear some of the cost of health insurance or of play or pay fees in the form of lower wages, the effects of those provisions on employment and hours worked is likely to be relatively minor. In an overall sense, that might be true, but such requirements do have a significant impact on certain specific segments of the labor market. In particular, a pay-or-play provision tends to reduce the hiring of low-wage workers whose wages aren't high enough to offset or absorb even a part of the cost of health insurance premiums or fees. We think that a proposal to look into another funding system for Oregon's healthcare situation is ill-timed at this point, and we would urge you not to move this bill forward. Thank you.
Are there questions in the room? I do have a question, if I can. One of the things that I've heard is that employers that provide health insurance, when they're competing with employers that don't provide health insurance, feel disadvantaged by that. Is AOI sort of universally interested in this, or are there some, interest in not doing it? Or is it pretty unanimous in a sense among
on
your
a payer,
constituency?
On a pay-or-play system?
Yeah.
Pretty unanimous, I think.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Dr. Smith.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, I'm, for the record, Janine Smith, the administrator for the Office of Health Policy and Research inside the Oregon Health Authority. And I am here today to talk about 3632 in terms of the impact on the office. And we've worked with Representative Witt and believe that the language in the Dash 1 amendments are in keeping with what we can do inside our current existing resources that you were generously giving us through the House Bill 2009 process that ties in well with our comprehensive health plan deliverable that we have back to you by later this year. And this bill explicitly pulls out a more focused attention to that, but we think we can do that with the Dash 1 amendments. We also had recommended some changes around exactly the wording to avoid any potential ERISA issues in terms of making sure that the study would look at viability. And so some of the language in the amendment was to reflect that, because in terms of our work in the past during the Health Fund Board process and our consultations with ERISA experts on how to best word that, and we are feel that with the Dash 1 amendments, there would not be a fiscal impact. And just pushing that through the process to have your completed fiscal ready.
Yes, sir.
I thought that really the goal of the health authority in this was to get the resources to do the study. That was my first belief. My second one is...
You're a cynic.
Okay. You think so?
I think so.
Okay. The second one is, doesn't the authority have the ability to do this now without this bill? I mean, we gave you a kind of broad authority to investigate a whole list of things, and I think the list was not inclusive. I mean, it wasn't all inclusive. So that, in fact, you could do this without this language in a new statute.
Chair Greenlich, Representative Maurer, you are correct in that the language was very broad, and we were, having looked at how an exchange works in Massachusetts, this is certainly an element that has been, we've looked at how Massachusetts has tried to apply this to their exchange, and so it was going to be part of our thinking and work. We think, though, that we can, do a little more detailed recommendations and policy recommendations more specifically to this, to address the direction in the bill. But I'm saying that basically we were going to be looking at this. Yes.
But the question is, do you need this statutory language to do what you were going to do? Or I mean, it may be giving you more direction, but my colleague could go over and say, this is what you need to include. And
Chair Greenlich, Representative Maurer, we can go either way. We certainly were going to include that back to you in our analysis. So this just clarifies that more specifically. We want to make sure that we adequately answer the questions around pay or play to Representative Witt and others' interests.
Okay.
Debbie.
McKenna?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not looking at any amendments to the bill, so I apologize if this got changed. But
Especially the amendment takes out the requirement to have an implementation plan if it turns out to be feasible.
Okay. The date in the original version of the bill, I think, is October 10th.
Chair Greenlich, Representative Cannon, I think originally it was October, and the amendment has December.
Okay. Which is
which is actually always a wonderful thing, but we can work with either date.
Is the date in the amended? In the amendment consistent with the date in House Bill 2009, which I'm looking at, it's a December 31st report from the board to the legislature on this open-ended list of reform ideas.
Correct.
Okay, so we would, if I may, so this bill would not mean yet another report. It would simply help shape, perhaps, right, the topics that are covered in the report that you were working on anyway.
Chair Greenlich, Representative Cannon, yes, it gives us just a little more granular detail exactly what that report needs to include around the payer plan.
Thank you. Okay, thank you all very much. I'll close the public hearing. We will carry over House Bill 3632 to tomorrow, when we should have a fiscal. If it comes with a zero fiscal, as I expect, and we pass it, I'll ask for the subsequent referral to Ways and Means to be removed, but we'll see how that goes. I've got a little dilemma now here. On the two bills, HB 3639, we have about 12 or so people signed up to testify. That is a bill that we could move to Ways and Means. We have the stuff if we have a quorum. The other bill we won't be moving to Ways and Means. I mean, we will not be moving. Is Representative Nathanson here? Vaughn. Okay. Well, then we will start. Then I'll open 3639. I'll ask everybody to please be brief. The intention is Our consideration is to move this to Ways and Means. There's a price tag on it that will have to be considered in Ways and Means, but that will be the motion on the floor. Open a public hearing on 3639, and I guess I'll just go down the list if I can read the names. If I can't read the names, then I won't call you or I'll mangle your name. Start with Jonathan Ames. Dr. Kendall Graven, is that correct? And Dean Larson. Let's take those three.
Is that Emmis?
Is it?
An Emmis?
No, it's Ames, I think.
I'm gonna, Joanna.
Next will be Brian DeLashmet, Valerie Reese, and Doug Barber.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jonathan Ames, and I'm here to represent the Handwriting Institute of America. I apologize for my poor handwriting. Took a while for people to think. Anyway, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jonathan Ames, and I am here on behalf of Coalition for Healthy Oregon. We represent managed care plans in the state, and we're here to talk about and be in support of House Bill 3639. This bill was brought before this committee in a similar form and fashion last legislative session. It had been worked on during in your committee and passed out and down to Ways and Means, and unfortunately the bill met with obviously some financial restrictions, and we understand that. Again, this bill as drafted has some financial issues. Obviously there's a large price tag as we aim to provide a repayment loan program for primary care physicians, nurse practitioners, and physicians assistants in the bill. I won't go into a lot of the detail about the bill, but I will say, as you have heard a number of times in this committee, primary care and the need for additional primary care practitioners, whether that be a doctor, a physician's assistant, or a nurse practitioner, it's critically important that we do something on this as soon as we can. We've waited long enough, and what we would like to do and what we'd like to see this bill move down into the Ways and Means Committee, where we can work on it further and hopefully get that fiscal down. We understand the financial restrictions we have this legislative session, but we feel it's very important we do something now as opposed to later to move this bill along. So I'm going to turn it over to the experts who know more about primary care, the difficulties and the challenges that we face recruiting physicians here in the state of Oregon, and also retaining physicians, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners here in the state of Oregon. So I will turn it over to colleagues here. Thank you.
Chairman Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dean Larson. I'm the executive director of the Marion Pope County Medical Society, and also in this capacity for this bill, representing the Mid-Valley Independent Physicians Association, our partnership for recruiting physicians, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants to Marion Pope County. Most of what I'd have to say, and in the effort to keep it brief, is already in the written testimony that I've been provided to you. I would just tell you that due to our based on a recent survey by Salem Hospital, our area, just our two counties, is over 180 physicians short of what we need to meet the population. I have absolutely no internal medicine doctors taking new patients, regardless of how they can pay, because they're all full in both counties. When it comes out to our going out recruiting, my on-staff recruiter and I go to five or six career fairs for residents and fellows, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners that are within a year of deciding where they're going to open their first practice. And at any one of those, we see 100 to 200 candidates. Among that, less than 20% of those would be primary care. That's not what the schools are turning out. When they practice medicine, it really doesn't matter where they practice the medicine. The four walls doesn't matter where they're located, that's medicine. So their decision on where they open their practice is really based on lifestyle and financial considerations. We offer a lot of incentives, or try to bring physicians to our area. I don't think I have to sell the lifestyle. They either like it or they don't. I believe this is a great place to live, but at any one of these events that we go to, there'll be anywhere from 40 to 50 representatives there from all over the country trying to recruit the same positions. And they all feel it's the best place to live also. Anything that this bill could do to help in an incentive for primary care physicians to relocate here, it is part of their decision process. They are being offered an awful lot of incentives elsewhere in the country, and we're doing what we can do, but I appreciate anything that the state can do to help us in that effort.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Kendall Graven, MD, and I am primary care. I'm a family physician and have been for 20 years.
What are you doing wasting your time here? You should be back seeing patients.
Exactly. Today's my half day, so I gave you my half day that I have off. I do have some titles, but that's not really why I'm here. I am the former chair of primary care at Salem Hospital. That's internal medicine, pediatrics, and family medicine. I'm the current chair of family medicine at Salem Hospital. I'm also the residency director here at for the Marion Polk Medical Association and the IPA here in town. But that's not really why I'm here. I'm here because I see patients for a living, 60 to 70 hours a week. That's what I do, primary care. And I'm also the guy that gets to try and recruit people for our own clinic. I happen to belong to Salem Clinic, which is a larger clinic. We have some resources. We have the resources to bring people in and interview them. But what I fear is my colleagues. I have colleagues of mine that are in one and two and three doctor offices, good old-fashioned family medicine and internal medicine practices, and they're disappearing. And the reason is they don't have the resources to compete. They just do not. I'm very afraid of the corporatization of primary care and medicine in general. Not that big clinics are a bad thing. My clinic that I belong to is a big thing. I think the variety of medicine is critical. It's critical to Oregonians. It's critical to the people who seek care to be able to find a doctor that they can hook with, that they can really get to know and can take care of them. That's what primary care is all about. I'm very much in support of House Bill 3639. The main reason is because we're not graduating enough residents in Oregon to replace even attrition, much less catch up on the number of patients who don't have a doctor. If Washington, D.C. ever gets their act together or something happens and more people get insured, it won't make any difference. There aren't primary care doctors to take care of them. We at our clinic turn away 800 patients a month that we don't have the resources to take care of, and we're actively recruiting. So I encourage you to view this bill favorably. I do think that it will help us in our recruiting efforts. I think a lot more is needed, but that's not what's on the table today. This is what's here today. And I would be happy to answer any questions for you.
Thank you very much. I do want to make a comment on the residency. I met with Dean Richardson yesterday, and I'm convinced the kind of stuff we're talking about here is useful, but the critical thing I think is to double the number of residency slots we have in primary care in the state, and I'm really committed to taking a serious look at that between now and the 2011 session and try and see what we can do, because I think your point is right. We have the slots full. It's just not, it's like trying to use a garden hose on this fire. I think we need to open up that slot a lot more and get more residencies going.
Mr. Chair, I couldn't agree more. I happen to also be the person who's chairing the investigative committee at Salem Hospital to see whether or not we have the resources and the will to start a residency program here in Salem. So I don't disagree. As a matter of fact, I wholeheartedly agree. I think that to solve this primary care problem, we got to do more than just 3639, but that's what's here today.
Okay, thank you guys very much. Brian DeLashmet, Valerie Riss, is that? R-I-S-S?
Riss,
okay. And Doug Barber. Following that will be Richard Harris, Scott Eggblatt, and Stephanie Kaplan. Or maybe, now, we'll see how we fit Phil Donovan.
Mr. Chair, Brian DeLashmet here representing the Oregon Nurses Association. Being a veteran lobbyist and seeing the signal very direct from the chair, I'll close by saying the Oregon Nurses Association supports this bill. Thank you.
Good bill should be. Thank you.
Here, here.
You got the right signal.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Valerie Riss. I'm a second-year medical student at OHSU. I'm also in the Master's of Public Health. I'm in the Master's program.
Yay.
So I'm here today to support House Bill 3639, which creates the loan repayment. Well, you guys know what it is. So I'm from Portland. I grew up in Portland. I went to undergrad at Stanford University, played water polo there. Came back to, oh, I worked in Hood River for a while at the Migrant Head Start there as a health assistant. A lot of my family lives in Hood River. And then I came back to OHSU, and my family was very happy that I'm in Oregon still. So in terms of this bill, we all know as medical students that there's a huge primary care shortage. We also know that it's a wonderful field to go into. The problem being, I've already had conversations with many of the students in terms of the difficult financial decision that we're going to be making. I just got a letter from the university in terms of what I paid this year, just in 2009, of $40,000 I paid, and I'm an in-state student. The out-of-state students are $60,000, and that's 1 year. I'm looking at a five-year program. I come out with a lot of money. We all would
tuition
like...
Tuition won't be that much for this year.
Well, that's true. That's true. Okay. 4 years and then a half of that. hopefully.
Agree. I'm sure part of that program because I started the MD-MBH program at OHSU.
It's a great program. I'm part of the health policy interest group as well, and we've had discussions on this bill in particular, and there's two reasons specifically that we're very, very excited about this bill. The first being that somebody is recognizing the decision that we're trying to make here, and that people want to go into primary care and they just feel like they can't. And the second being that this bill actually is a repayment program so that we don't have to decide what specialty we want to go in before we get to medical school, which is impossible. It's half the people, I mean, I didn't know what palliative medicine was when I was going into medical school. It's a specialty I'd never even heard of, and it's something that I learned about. I change my mind every week what kind of specialty I want to go into. So we like the fact that it's a repayment program so that we can find out what we want to do while we're going through. We don't feel like we're going to be punished after the fact. So that's me. Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
What are you guessing your total burden, your total debt burden will be at the end of a residency program?
Well, thankfully, I don't have debt coming out of undergrad. I got a water polo scholarship, and my family helped me out. But that's not true for a lot of my colleagues. My medical school debt will be probably around $200,000. I try not to add it up beforehand.
You know, if my proposal to merge OHSU and PSU, you might be able to get a water polo scholarship to medical school, but that's off in the future.
Nice reach. Oh, gratuitous, Mr. Chair. Oh, so gratuitous.
Yes, I don't know if you can answer this or not, but to me, it seems like $10,000 isn't all that competitive if we're really trying to attract people.
Well,
other states
offer
are offering
more.
Other programs.
I shall take more.
Yeah, I mean,
sorry.
Is this something that would be interesting, or would you just rather go to Texas and get a bigger payout?
I don't want to go to Texas.
Okay.
No, I think that people really want to practice here. I think that people that want to practice rural want to practice rural because that's where they want to live.
Yeah.
Anything that can help out with just allowing you to make that decision is huge, because we'd like to make the decision. It's the fact that you just feel like you're being held back from making the decision.
Mr. Barber, Mr. Zlashman has been a wonderful role model.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Doug Barber here today on behalf of the Oregon Academy of Family Physicians. Dr. Steiner could not be here and asked me to fill in for her. We're here to speak in opposition to the bill as introduced. There's no doubt that we are strong supporters of primary care, and we know that loan repayment is probably the best tool available to support physicians, young physicians coming out of school, and especially in terms of recruitment. At the November committee meeting of your committee, you asked the Academy of Family Physicians to put together a package of primary care legislation for the 2011 session. We took that very seriously and are working diligently to make that happen. And we will be working throughout the spring with a host of the other healthcare organizations, OMA, ONA, and so on, to try to pull together a package that we can all support. No doubt loan repayment will be a key provision in that bill. But we believe that as huge as the need is for primary care, the need for rural health care is even greater. And it's important for the legislature to prioritize the money that you have to spend, especially, and to prioritize the greatest need first. We had a loan repayment program for rural health care in the state that for over the last 15 years was, I think, no, 11 years, was woefully underfunded. It was funded at about $400,000 per biennium. The Washington State program, similarly, that recruits rural healthcare practitioioners, has $8 million in their fund. So, and that's who rural healthcare facilities are competing against. So we believe that if you have money this session to spend on loan repayment in healthcare, that those first dollars should go into the rural health loan repayment fund, which applies to physicians, PAs, nurse practitioners, dentists, pharmacists. And once that is adequately funded, and we can debate about what's adequate, but at least a significant contribution toward rural health, there will be right there with everybody else supporting a broader loan repayment program for primary care in general. I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Thank you very much, Judge. We have, okay. Richard Harris, Scott Ekblad. And why don't we have Tom Holt next, and then we'll have Stephanie Kaplan and Phil Donovan as the last. Tom, come on, yeah.
We have
Richard Harris, Scott, and Tom.
Mr. Harris here? Okay.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tom Holt. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I'll be very brief. Our view on this bill is much what Doug Barber just expressed. We too see the need to do better at recruiting primary care physicians into our state, but we also hear from our members that the highest need is in the rural areas, and right now we have no funding in that program, and we would appreciate that being prioritized. And the bill itself as drafted, although a lot of conversation has gone on about it, we think still needs some sideboards. I mean, as written, for instance, someone going to work at one of the boutique pay a membership to get in quick primary care clinics would be eligible for this program as written, and we don't think that's appropriate. So with that, I'll close. Thank you.
Go ahead. Scott?
All right. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Ekblad. I'm the director of the Oregon Office of Rural Health. And I just want to start out by saying I, like everyone else, is very much in support of anything to increase the supply of primary care providers. However, as someone who has been involved in the administration of the Rural Health Services Loan Repayment Program, which was defunded during the last session, I can say the devil is truly in the details. I have some concerns about this bill, and I'll try to be brief. Again, the need in rural Oregon is far greater than in the rest of the state. And just as one example, primary care physicians, there's one primary care physician for every 720 urban Oregonians, one primary care physician for every 1,298 rural people. And the same ratios, the same disparity in ratios is true for nurse practitioners and PAs as well. One of the other pieces of the bill is that beneficiaries must be in practice for 12 months before they become eligible for this program. Well, that in and of itself makes it a retention tool rather than a recruitment tool. Also, the fact that the benefit is $10,000 at the most per year. Again, that is a retention incentive rather than recruitment. What we're talking about competing with is National Health Service Corps loan repayment is $37,500 per year at a maximum. And in the typical state program is $25,000 to $35,000 a year in loan repayment. So this bill, as written, really is a retention program rather than recruitment. Also, the bill does not require that physicians actually apply this loan repayment to their outstanding loans. And the way the bill is written, they're eligible for the program as long as they have an outstanding loan. So I guess technically you can not pay off your loans but get this benefit for a long time. Also, $10,000, again, not much money. We have to remember that it's considered taxable income on both the state and the federal level. So the actual benefit after taxes is going to be a bit less than $10,000. I'm also concerned that the only eligibility criterion is that providers have an active primary care practice. So the question that arises for me is the person who's practicing one day a week going to get the same benefit as the person who's practicing 60, 70 hours a week? And then finally, there's no limits on how many providers can take advantage of this program. The way it's currently written, every primary care provider in the state who has an outstanding loan would be eligible for this program. So to me, there are several problems with this bill. The Office of Rural Health, I personally, all of my staff are more than happy to work together to find a program that meets everyone's needs and addresses the needs where they are the greatest. So
thank you.
I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you both very much.
Question.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Chair Scott, just briefly, I want to make sure I have the number right. If we had money to restore the rural program, how much would we need?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Kotek, the Rural Health Services Loan Repayment Program was funded at $400,000 per biennium. That's the same amount of funding as when it was created in 1989. And in reality, what that allowed us to do was squeeze four practitioners per year into that program.
That's all.
That's all.
And what happened to the folks who were in when the program got cut?
The program was administered such that when an award was made, the funds were put aside for the entire obligation. So okay. Those who were in the program still continue to receive the benefit. We just can't make any new awards.
Okay. Thank you.
One other quick question.
Go for it.
And also, did I hear you correctly that the other states are putting in $25,000+ per year in loan repayments?
Chair Greenlick, Representative Harker, that's true. Yeah.
That's an average number?
Correct. Our office, the Office of Rural Health, recently applied for and received a federally funded state loan repayment program. It gets very confusing. But it's federally funded for state loan repayment. Mm-hmm. It requires a one-to-one match. There's several limitations to this program as well. But the award that we will be paying is, I believe it's roughly $30,000 per year.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Can I have Stephanie Kaplan and Phil Donovan? Briefly. While they're coming up, let me tell you that I think it's clear there's not the money to fund this in this session. But we and I was prepared to let it die here. But we've been asked instead to send it to Ways and Means without recommendation. And I'll be accepting a motion to do that as soon as we're done with this testimony and move into work session. And you either vote yes or no. Yes.
Chair Greenlick, House Committee. Thanks for having me here today. I'm Dr. Stephanie Kaplan. Hi. Hi again. I'm a naturopathic physician. I have a solo practice in Portland. I've been practicing since 2001 when I graduated from the National College of Natural Medicine in Portland. I see men, women, and children of all ages for any ailment they can come up with. I also do preventive medicine exams for all of my patients. I got involved with the OMP soon in the beginning of my practice because I'm passionate about access to health care for all Oregonians, not just the ones who currently can see me as a naturopathic physician. As a profession and as a committee, we're all appropriately concerned about the shortage of primary care in Oregon. We applaud the intent of House Bill 3639 and respectfully request the inclusion of our profession in this bill. Naturopathic physicians already serve as primary care in a variety of settings, anywhere from community clinics to private clinics and multidisciplinary clinics, including alongside other primary care providers and subspecialists. Like medical doctors, we naturopathic physicians graduate with a doctoral degree, along with a minimum of $189,000 in debt. In Stafford loan debt, which is specifically the federal loans that we are eligible for as naturopathic physicians. Loan repayment legislation is needed to help encourage people to enter primary care, especially in Oregon and rural areas, particularly in my mind. The only way to resolve the shortage of primary care doctors is to include all qualified healthcare professions in this bill. As you consider this legislation, we request your inclusion of an amendment to House 3639 to include naturopathic physicians as defined by ORS 685. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Kaplan.
Mr. Chair, just two quick points. My name is Phil Donovan. I do government relations work for the Oregon Association of Naturopathic Physicians. First off, I just wanted to share that some of you are asking, is this the most effective strategy, loan repayment? I met with over 100 students last week at the National College of Natural Medicine, and they were emphatic in saying yes, and you'll probably see your email inboxes reflect that shortly.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome. Secondly, sometimes you're interested in what takes place in the neighboring states and around the country. I did want to point out that the Washington Loan Repayment has a program, and it's specific to their rural health program, but they do have a loan repayment program, and that does include naturopathic physicians underneath their program. We worked on this legislation primarily on the Senate side this last legislative session under Senate Bill 12, where we were working on incentives to get into rural and medically underserved. This legislation is a bit broader. It doesn't go into that sort of specificity, but it is something that we've been supportive of. So with that, I'll close. We appreciate time and attention and would respectfully request inclusion of our profession within this bill. Thank you, sir.
You can take that back up again in Ways and Means when it gets considered there. Thank you very much for your testimony. Close the public hearing on House Bill 3639. Open a work session on House Bill 3639. Mr. Maurer?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3639 to the floor without without recommendation as to passage, and the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Great. That's a hard one. Okay, we have a motion on the floor. Is there a discussion on the motion?
Down here.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, one of our two Ways and Means members here.
At the risk of making some folks unhappy, I can't support this motion. We need to prioritize. We do not have the money. The bill is too, there's too much work that needs to get done on this bill. And we won't do it in Ways and Means, and I think it sends a poor message to send something that needs work to Ways and Means. Pick whatever issue you heard today. There's a lot to do. I do think we need to talk about priorities. We don't have the money to fund the rural loan repayment program either. I can't support sending this to Ways and Means.
Representative Nathanson, do you have a comment on this?
I don't have a comment because I don't even have any I don't have any information on the request to refer it to Ways and Means. It sounds like there were instructions to send it to Ways and Means.
No, it wasn't instructions.
Or just it was that it should go that route.
I very specifically said to, I mean, I'll just put this on the record, I said to the proponents that I was prepared to let it die here because I knew there wasn't the money for it and because of other work, and that because Representative Buckley had told me don't send things to Ways and Means, that to go to Ways and Means to die. So I asked that some of the proponents to speak with Representative Buckley, and they did. And he simply called me this morning and said it would be fine to send it to Ways and Means. But he certainly would do that on our I mean, he would want us to do that. He just withdrew his restriction. I think I'm compelled to listen to the Ways and Means members. That's why I asked you.
Mr. Chair, I can appreciate the desire to move it to Ways and Means to send a signal that we endorse this concept, but I share Representative Kotek's concern to try to ensure that we actually send a bill that we endorse. And I understand that the motion was without recommendation, but it would appear to sort of abrogate the responsibility of this committee to try to get the policy right. And if we're going to send the message that to 2011 or 2013 or beyond, let's send the kind of message we want to send, which might be rural health. It might be one of the other issues raised.
Mr. Chair, in a rare moment of group hug, I withdraw my motion.
Work session closed. I open a public hearing on House Bill 3642 and ask Representative Nathanson to kick us off. We don't have the ability to send this one today, is that right?
No.
Well, it doesn't have a prior reference.
We just killed it.
It has no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I spoke to this bill at a meeting of this committee in January. In a nutshell, I asked the committee to consider this bill, which provides more flexibility in operating health care clinics and supervising physician assistants who are part of the health delivery team. We know there's a shortage in primary care. We were just hearing about the shortage in primary care. It's important to increase and expand access to quality, affordable primary care in particular. To be sure, workforce shortages are one very large element that needs to be addressed, but it's not the only element. Reimbursement rates for primary care are another factor that need to be considered, but again, it's not the only factor. There is yet another component of the issue that we can address, and that's regulatory barriers. That's what this bill addresses. Clinics need the flexibility to provide care in the new world of healthcare delivery. This bill is about choice and affordability and being sure our laws aren't getting in the way of an effective healthcare system. There are two amendments that I have provided to the committee that I would like to be considered as well. The Dash 1 amendment indicates that the board will receive a list of the supervising physicians. And the Dash 3 amendment clarifies the accountability portion, whereby a primary supervising physician will be named. I want to mention quickly several points about what this bill is intended to do and what it does not do. It does not eliminate existing physician-physician assistant relationships or licenses. It doesn't eliminate it or prohibit it. It does not prohibit the mentoring and long-term physician-physician assistant relationships that have proven valuable to many of these teams. It does not change the authority of the board to license and oversee the work of the physician-physician assistant team. The medical board continues to ensure quality and provide oversight, as it does now, through rules and licensing, and can order corrective action to ensure patient safety. That's what the bill does not do. It doesn't change the authority of the board, prohibit the relationships. What it does do is it allows for an alternative path for supervising. It does maintain accountability by naming a primary physician. That would be through the Dash 3 amendment. It does put Oregon in place with other states who have already moved toward more flexibility. And it does set the stage for increasing access to affordable, quality primary health care. Simply put, this bill is about increasing access. I'd like to close with one sentence that I read in an article last month in Business Week. Quote, as we can see, resourcefulness is a key lens for creating next-generation health care that supports a patient's long-term health and creates true value, lower costs, improved results, and increased accessibility. Now, that article mentioned next-generation health care. This bill would allow some flexibility for this generation health care. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. We'll get your questions and discussion. Can I call David Saunders, Fran Biagioli.
Good job.
I did it, huh? I swear, I have one more to go right now. And Francine Buloso. How was that? Was I close?
Very good.
Jeez. Well, it's after 5 o'clock. Whoops.
I grew up in Detroit. I had lots of those names.
Greenlick and members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Saunders. I'm a licensed Oregon physician, and along with Dr. DiPiero, a co-founder of Zoom Care.
Could you speak up a little louder, please?
Sure, I will. And I'll sort of cut the chase. Today I'm just going to focus on two areas of interest, I believe, to all of you, and that is, what is the impact of HB 3642 on accountability and patient safety? To begin, I'll answer the question, what is the impact of HB 3642 on care quality and patient safety? This bill will enhance quality and safety. The Oregon Medical Board would continue to set standards for care quality and patient safety. Currently, the board sets standards in three areas. First, each PA must receive 8 hours per month of one-to-one in-person supervision. During this clinic session, the physician provides hands-on mentoring in the areas of diagnostic evaluation, therapeutics, and care plan development. Our organization and others exceed this standard with training curriculum, monthly quality scorecards, and delivery of unfiltered customer feedback, as well as paying for performance. Second, each PA must have their charts reviewed by a supervising physician. This percent ranges from all charts to 10% charts per the board's discretion. Chart reviews must be documented and available for audit. In our organization, chart reviews are comprised of numeric scores for quality and documentation and include full candor, written critiques. Third, each physician assistant must be continually in contact with their supervisor. In our organization, we schedule physicians to ensure on-demand, undivided attention to physician assistant consultation. Compliance with the above standards requires at least 20 hours of dedicated time per PA per month. In addition, PAs, like physicians and like nurse practitioners, must maintain multiple professional standards, and these include license renewal, annual compliance with medical education requirements, insurer credentialing and re-credentialing, which includes reviews from the National Practitioner Database for adverse events, and review from the Federation of State Medical Board Database for red flags filed in any U.S. state, and credential committee review and approval of candidates. And finally, medical malpractice application and renewals that include a review of claims history, adverse events, and sanctions. So taken in its entirety, the PA practice environment is marked by robust quality and safety checks and balances. The entire quality and safety regime remains fully intact with HB 3642. Further, the board remains authorized to develop new compliance methodologies through rulemaking. The board shall continue to develop corrective action plans for non-performing supervising organizations, just as it does today. So to the question, would HB 3642 permit excesses, such as one physician overseeing extreme numbers of PAs? My answer is, of course not. The supervision standards I outlined above are very demanding and time-intensive and simply make such egregious practices physically impossible. Public assurance of quality is not measured by arbitrary ratios, but by quality and safety mechanisms with teeth. HB 3642 preserves these mechanisms while injecting a degree of flexibility that will improve performance while enabling PAs to contribute more fully to solving our grave primary care clinician shortage. Next.
David, we have your written testimony.
Okay.
Could you make whatever point you want to make?
Sure. The last point is just that what is the impact on accountability? And certainly this bill preserves accountability. And the statute 677510 requires physicians to submit a practice plan
and empowers the board to approve, modify, withdraw, and revoke those practice plans just as it does today. So the main point is that the accountability regime remains fully intact and in measures of quality and safety.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Could be Biagioli?
Yes. So I am Dr. Fran Biagioli. I'm a family doctor.
I didn't get it quite right, but
it's pretty close. If you have to say Biagioli, you have to use your hands. So I'm a family doctor. I work in Portland. I'm a supervising physician as well, so I have a PA who works under my care. I am Oregon Medical Association Executive Committee member, and I'm also the medical director for the Oregon Health Sciences University PA program since 2004. So I come to this to testify in support the Oregon Medical Association to support this bill with the Dash 3 amendment. To be brief, which I know you want, the Dash 3 amendments, what they do is they allow the supervising organization to designate a go-to person, the buck stops here person.
They require it.
It requires it. And that was what was very necessary. To be able to name the physicians on the panel as well is very important because the physician assistant is trained in the model of having a partnership, a relationship with a person, not a relationship with an organization. And so what the Dash 3 amendments do is allow for that relationship to still be there. And so if they have a person who is the ultimate authority and have the names of, on Monday, I'm going to supervise with X person, Tuesday this, and there's a plan for that, then there still maintains a relationship. And that's what's key in the amendments. You will note that on page 2, line 20, it states, a supervising physician organization may supervise any number of physician assistants. The board may not adopt rules to limit the number of physician assistants that a supervising physician organization may supervise. This line is not intended to limit the board's authority. They have the ability to limit through corrective action. And so that doesn't change the board's ability to do what they need to do. And we want the OMA wanted to point out that we didn't believe that there was any issue with that particular line. I'm happy to take questions, but we are very much in support of this bill with the Dash 3 amendment.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, I'm Francine Belosa. I'm a physician assistant, and I've practiced in primary care in pediatrics in Oregon continuously since 1975. I've had the same supervising physician since 1988, and I think that speaks to the importance of the longevity and of a close relationship with a physician. I'm totally in support of this bill, and I would like to thank Representative Nathanson for your leadership on this, and Representative Greenlick and Representative Boyle and Kotek, who have been co-sponsors of this bill. The concern I had with this bill regarded on the bill as introduced on page 1, lines 18 to 21, that deletes some language. And I call your attention to that as it was introduced. It deletes language stating that the practice description shall provide, and then it ends with, but the description shall not require the physical presence at all times of the supervising physician. I have concerns about the deletion of that language, which has been in our law since at least 1983. And yet I understand that that may be solved by the Dash 3 amendment in which on page 2 a statement has been added that says the board may not require a supervising physician to be physically present at all times. So I believe that that Dash 3 language may satisfy my concern about the deletion on page 1 of lines 18 to 21, but I still wanted to bring it to your attention and be sure that you all agreed with that. And the Oregon legislature has a great history of supporting physician assistants in the state. I've been involved in my profession the entire time I've worked here, and way back to even 1989 when the Office of Rural Health was directed to find a way to establish a PA program in Oregon. And the Oregon Health Sciences University program has expanded from an initial 18 students to 40 per year. And Pacific University now also has a master's level physician assistant program. And so I think that it's great to see efforts to modernize the law some to allow for the changes that have occurred in the way patients do get care in the state, which supports increased access. So thank you very much.
Thank you. One quick question, I don't know who can answer it, but are our laws in Oregon for PAs in comparison to other states, are we, how do we line
we're
up?
More restrictive. When I say more restrictive,
we started more liberal and ended up more restrictive.
And so as compared to other states, especially with this ratio and such, we tend to be a little bit more. The fact that there is a ratio to begin with is kind of arbitrary. I mean, if I have a new graduate, it should be 1-on-1 versus a PA who's been in practice for 20 years, that probably would have a much higher ratio. So.
Maybe it needs to be revisited.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
We can do it in the interim. Mm-hmm. We have one more witness, and I'd like you to hang in because I'd like to open a work session for the purpose of adopting the two amendments so we can get the fiscal straightened out. Thank you all very much. Deborah Heron. You folks who testified today did a really good job. Mr. Lashmet, he gets the award for the week. Yes.
Chair Greenlicht, members of the committee, I'm Deborah Heron here on behalf of the Oregon Society of Physician Assistants, and you've just met one of our cherished longtime physician assistants in practice here in Oregon. We are here just to say that we support the Dash 3 amendments. It's a good bill, do pass. Thank you very much.
You're good too.
Nice.
Close the public hearing on 3642 and open a work session on 3642. And Representative Nathanson, take a motion.
Mr. Chair, would you like two separate motions?
I think two separate is better.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3642.
Is there any discussion on the Dash 1s? Any objections? They're in.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3642.
Is there any discussion? Any objection? They're in. We will close the work session on House Bill 3642. Now, I just want to make sure I have the record correct, and we are carrying over HB 3611, HB 3626, HB 3632, HB 3639, and HB. Yeah, we'll carry that over.
Okay.
For the record. And HB 3642.
Go up tomorrow.
Well, we have to carry it over each day, don't we? Yeah. So these will be carried over to tomorrow.
Okay.
Is there any? There was all of them.
I was just want to
keep them all around anyway.
Oh, okay.
Is there?
They'll all be carried over as work session.
They'll all be carried over as work session only, yes. Is there any other discussion? You guys did great. Thank you very much. Adjourn.
I don't know what.
Debbie?